Ideas Network. Coming up, have you ever revisited a park or rewatched a movie and enjoyed it more than you expected? Our next guest says repeat experiences can be more enjoyable than we might think. First, the Pentagon announced last week that it plans to reduce the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan to about 2,500 by January 20th. That would continue a drawdown of forces that's been happening since February, when about 12,000 troops were stationed in the country. The plan is part of a deal the U.S. struck with the Taliban early this year to open peace talks between the group and the national government. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Qatar this weekend to hold some of those talks, likely the last discussions held under the Trump administration. It's been a violent year in Afghanistan, and many in the country fear the Taliban will gain even more control if the U.S. continues to withdraw support. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the situation and the American troop presence in Afghanistan? Do you think it's time for American troops to get out of the country, maybe entirely, regardless of where things stand there? Or do you think we need to leave the country with a better chance at stability, if that's possible? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Saeed, for some time, U.S. troops in Afghanistan haven't been in combat mode as we know it. Can you talk about what their role has been recently?
Basically, the role for U.S. troops has been one to try to facilitate and in themselves also to engage in counterterrorism activities. There are still some vestiges of Al-Qaeda, but perhaps more problematically, there's always a concern that Afghanistan could be fertile ground for ISIS, or ISIL, as it's known. And given the rather dubious legacy of American involvement in Afghanistan, it was always considered to be prudent for there to be some kind of military presence there, especially in the backdrop of the kind of tensions that exist between the Taliban and a rather weak central government in Kabul.
This all started, the American troop presence there started after the September 11 attacks, with the notion, the reality that the Taliban had in effect given refuge to Al-Qaeda leadership back then. Now I understand the Trump administration and American negotiators are trying to get a deal where the Taliban will say, we won't provide a harbor to Al-Qaeda or a group like ISIS or things like that. How plausible does an agreement like that seem?
There is space for the Taliban to be able to make that pledge, but the Taliban understand that anything dealing with an Afghanistan government and also with Washington is a transactional relationship. And so Taliban is not going to simply make that pledge without getting something in return. And what they want is either greater say when it comes to the direction of Kabul's government, or at the very least having as much autonomy in the regions that it controls. So they can go ahead and hold this out as a bargaining chip when it comes to with whom they have relations, and particularly with those people that find themselves to be on the other side of American interests in the region.
There's a lot of concern, I understand, in Afghanistan. If the Taliban can take power again in the whole country, they're obviously, they have great influence in a lot of the country now, that some reverses could be expected in terms of human rights, women's rights, things like that. What are the concerns there?
That's always going to be a concern when it comes to Afghanistan. Now, the Taliban don't have the manpower, nor do they have the kind of influence or weapons that they could then be able to comprehensively take Afghanistan. There's simply too many different players that are at work there. However, at the same time, it also has to be recognized that the Taliban, whether one likes it or not, are a legitimate presence within Afghanistan. They are going to need to have a seat at the table. And right now, it seems as though the impasse when it comes to the negotiations with the Kabul government are over even agreeing on something as simple as a code of conduct. What is going to be the negotiation protocols that are used in their talks in Qatar? If the issue of human rights is going to be on the table, which it should, there is going to have to be a recognition of the Taliban refracting human rights through Islamic law. Now, all Islamic law, of course, is not something that is inimical to human rights or even women's rights, but it has to be seen as something that is homegrown within Afghanistan. It is an indigenous recognition and an indigenous agreement, not one that is necessarily being influenced by external forces there.
And there's been a lot of interest from external forces who have supported the Taliban over the years, including Pakistani intelligence agencies, wealthy investors, in effect, from Saudi Arabia. Is that still a concern that these outside forces are, well, there are lots of them, are still playing a big role in supporting the Taliban?
Well, here again is one of the ironies, because along with, as you said, so the investors, Pakistani intelligence, Indian intelligence, there are plenty of different outside forces, as well as the United States. When it comes to the Saudis, it seems as though there has been a withdrawal of their expansion of influence in the region. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the country itself is trying to perhaps reinvent itself when it comes to the moniker of being the exporter of Wahhabism and Islamic fundamentalism. At the same time, Saudi Arabia is also now focusing much more inward to domestic reforms, trying to, in fact, promote tourism to the kingdom. In the case of Pakistan, what you have is the all-important China-Pakistan economic corridor, which is going to involve Afghanistan as well. So Pakistani intelligence forces are going to ensure that that is something that is kept front and center in their priorities and looking for stabilization in Afghanistan. As far as India is concerned, India's motivation is less regarded on matters of economics or really a concern for Afghanistan, but they see themselves as providing a counterweight to Pakistani influence there. So again, unfortunately, and not for the first time, Afghanistan is really the locus of external forces. It remains to be seen if it can provide for itself the kind of stability which will then repel many of these external actors from feeling as though they have the empowerment to engage there.
Talking to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University, looking at plans from the Trump administration to draw down the number of American troops, some more in Afghanistan amidst ongoing negotiations. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jake?
You know, I just think it's a great opportunity as we draw down for Afghani men and women to really take the helm and, you know, gain some either political or human rights wins for the people. I think when we see an Afghani man or woman as the face of this change, I think it's going to inspire a lot of the community or the Afghanis to really start to see the change that's been made and the progress that's been made. And among other things, I know that we've had a lot of opportunity to provide resources, you know, both human and financial, to start helping and aiding their government to kind of resume things in a transition. So I think it's going to be a great opportunity to slowly, you know, let more and more of that influence take root. And I think there's going to be a lot more organic support for their government. And I think there's going to be a great change for the people to see that.
Jake, thanks a lot for calling in. And Saeed, that was the hope, I think, from the George W. Bush administration, the Obama administration, is that as the United States pulls out, the Afghan government and the Afghan people would be able to step up and fill any void that American troop presence had left behind. What do you think?
Well, I think, as Jake said, that is still the kind of cautious optimism by which all parties concerned are operating. This has been going on for a very long time, and American involvement, at least from 2001 on, was for a legitimate reason. This was the area where the Taliban was harboring al-Qaeda. It was not Iraq. And of course, for decades to come, people will analyze and assess whether the United States should have focused on Afghanistan, and perhaps that particular conflict could have ended a lot sooner than it has or still going on. The other thing to recognize is that this idea of agency of a very, very diverse Afghan political society needs to have the opportunity to germinate and to even make mistakes on its own, whether it is the government of Ashraf Ghani in Kabul, the Taliban, as well as other groups. Afghanistan is not a country with which we would have a very natural cultural understanding or frame of reference. You have large tribal ethos there. You have a weak central government, and you still have a lot of political differences when it comes to representation. What we understand as a democratic process is different in Afghanistan. There, they do have representational government, but it would certainly not be mistaken for being a Jeffersonian democracy. It should be allowed to organically develop. It is a country that has been through a tremendous amount dating well before 2001. In fact, going to the 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, in which the United States certainly played an indirect role in ending not only Soviet invasion there, but really bringing down the Soviet Union as a whole by 1989. Now we find that the challenge is really to allow the Afghans to create their own kind of political regime, and one that should be left to its own devices instead of having foreign intervention.
We're talking to Saeed Khan right now, senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University, looking at the latest plans for a reduction of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about Afghanistan and the political and military situation there, what it might take to achieve stability? Do you think the U.S. should leave some troops in Afghanistan to support the government there, to combat ISIS and al-Qaeda, or do you think it's time for more withdrawal, maybe a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Saeed Khan from Wayne State University, looking at the Trump administration's goal to reduce the number of troops in Afghanistan to about 2,500 by late January. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers now. Franco is with us in Grand Marsh. Franco, hello.
Hi. Good afternoon. My question for your guest is, after all these years in Afghanistan, I'm just curious, why do you think it is that the U.S., the Western allies, and the Middle East countries haven't helped Afghanistan build up a really formidable army and air force so they can stand on their own and be independent? God bless.
Franco, thanks a lot for calling in. Saeed, that has been part of the goal for the U.S. and NATO allies in particular for a long time now, right?
Well, first of all, thank you for the question, Franco. The idea of building a standing army and an air force would be important if Afghanistan was threatened from outside. What we find is the case of Afghanistan is really something that is completely internal. And we find also that there are these various groups that have their own security forces, their own militias, their own mode of operating, whether it's the Taliban or the central government or various other tribal factions as well, such as the Northern Alliance. That's not the problem. There's plenty of weapons in Afghanistan. It's just that they're using them against one another. Now, at the same time, there have been occasions where external forces have then been, for their own needs of fighting some kind of a proxy war, been enabling and empowering and equipping various sides to this conflict. So what we find then is that if it is about Afghanistan coming together and getting stability, more military, more weapons is really not the solution to this. There needs to be security, but that security needs to be from one another. There has to be, for that, the real restoration of trust.
How do you do that? I mean, after all these years of Afghanistan at war, either with an external force like the Soviet Union or various versions of a civil war, how do you start to come back from that?
There's two things. One is that with the bilateral talks that are going on in Qatar, there needs to be a very strong statement made to all parties that have served as external forces, whether it is India, Pakistan, the United States, certainly Saudi Arabia, that Afghanistan should be hands-off. Now, some of them have reasons which can be justified because of their own security reasons and priorities. And for others, it seems as though it's much more folly and to serve as a disruptive force. Once that is taken care of, then there also needs to be the building of trust among the Afghan factions themselves. When that happens and there is the incentivization that everybody is a stakeholder in Afghanistan, no one is going to be excluded or exempted from the process of building or rebuilding Afghanistan. There's a trust dividend that comes in naturally as a result of that. If this was as it was in the past, the exclusion of the Taliban, then it wouldn't be a surprise for them to take the kind of posture of resistance that they would, recognizing and sensing that Kabul was hostile to their interests as being Afghans, not some kind of external interlopers.
Thanks a lot for that call, Franco, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Colleen calling from Sharon now. Colleen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the state of women and girls in Afghanistan as the United States is leaving in regards to not only their participation in government and government rebuilding, but education, jobs, and their standing today.
Colleen, thanks for the call. Saeed.
Right. So the situation for women in Afghanistan is certainly not ideal. And in part, that has to do with the kind of instability of the government, instability in society. And part of that is also when it comes to economics. Now, there is a possibility that with the right kind of investment in Afghanistan, that the empowerment of women and human rights as a whole can improve. China is really, at this point, the main variable. With its Belt and Road Initiative, or the so-called Silk Road, that's going to extend from Beijing all the way to Europe, we see then the possibility that Chinese investment in Afghanistan can then help provide a kind of economic buoyancy for this completely landlocked country to then have within it a kind of an economic stability which can bring everybody forward. Part of the reason why women's rights are subdued in Afghanistan is because of the imbalance of education being available to everybody. Women are educated or they have access to education based not on matters of gender or culture, but because of socioeconomics, whereas large swaths of the population may not have access to those resources. So if there is that kind of an incentive that can be provided, and China, of course, doesn't like instability. So what they could probably do is, along with the kind of economic benefits and resources, they can also demand and receive a kind of stability within the society, which can then allow, and I assure you, it'll probably be a slow process, maybe a little bit slower than to which we are accustomed. But there is a possibility then that the situation for women can improve. It will probably be measured more in decades than in years, though.
Colleen, thanks for the call. We're talking to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University about Afghanistan and the U.S. troop presence there. Back to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good afternoon. I am very concerned about what is happening over there with the neighbors to Afghanistan, as well as the history of this war we've had in that country. And I think it's very much destabilized by the fact that for a time in Afghanistan, we got them to stop growing opium, which, you know, supplies drug addicts with heroin. And there's so much money in drug trade. I want to know what the guest thinks of how destabilizing drugs are in the culture of Afghanistan and what the future holds in that regard. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Saeed, great question. The role of opium production in Afghanistan.
Well, I like the way that Jeff framed the question, so thank you, because the whole notion of destabilization is really in the eye of the beholder. Afghanistan itself would perhaps, and I don't want to speak for the entire country, but certainly one sector will contend that opium production, in fact, is not destabilizing. It provides some modicum of economic stability. what would be the best strategy in dealing with opium, particularly with its more adverse impact elsewhere in the world when it comes to heroin and the such, is to go ahead and provide a replacement crop. One of the big challenges is that opium grows quite well. There are other agricultural products that can be grown. And if there was an arrangement, for example, with China that is always looking for other areas that can be food producers, there can be then an incentivization to replace opium in the fields with something that would be more viable, and at the same time try to provide it with the same level of financial profitability. Now, that, of course, is a big issue, because given the fact that the opium trade is rather lucrative, so there will be some kind of an economic impact on Afghanistan. But if there can be, again, some kind of subsidies that are provided, some kind of long-term stability that can be offered in the financial sector, there is some hope that we can wean the country off the kind of dependency for a product which, like it or not, does provide some kind of economics for it.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Saeed, what are you watching for as we make the transition to a new president in this country, a new Secretary of State, and the whole shebang? What are you watching for in this transition when it comes to Afghanistan?
So there's two things. One is whether or not the withdrawal of the United States from the Middle East and from South Asia in by and large is going to continue. It seems as though the Biden administration is coming in with a couple of major priorities. One is to restore the transatlantic relationship that has really suffered over the last 4 years, particularly with NATO. Another priority, of course, is how to contain China, which is going to be difficult with the recent signing of the agreement, the RCEP, in with many Asian and Pacific Rim countries. Afghanistan is not going to be a very high priority, it seems, for the United States, but at the same time, it should not be neglected or ignored. We're paying the price for that happening in 1989, and we're paying the price of still, as yet, not having a very coherent strategic plan and policy for the country.
Saeed, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. He talked to us today about a plan to withdraw more U.S. troops from Afghanistan and ongoing peace talks between the U.S., the Taliban, and the Afghan government. Coming up after the news, have you ever visited the same museum exhibit twice, or maybe reread a book or rewatched a movie? Our next guest says repeat experiences like those are underrated and we should give them more of a chance. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, there's been some good news about vaccines lately, but what will it take to get them distributed and used around the country? Kate Archer-Kent talks to a doctor about the practical side of vaccine distribution. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, if we're going to spend our free time doing something, a lot of people might hesitate to choose doing something we've already done before, like going to watch the same movie or taking a walk on the same path as the day before, or a trip to a place we've been before. But research by our next guest shows that repeat experiences are underrated. They can be just as enjoyable, if not more so, than entirely new experiences. And there could be some important lessons in there for today's pandemic world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been finding some joy in re-watching movies or re-reading books? Have you been able to find some peace in a routine, even though it's a lot of the same? What is a repeat experience, past or present, that you've enjoyed? Have you ever gone to see the same movie at a theater more than once, when we saw movies in theaters? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ed O'Brien is an experimental social psychologist and associate professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think for some people, and as I understand it, even some people in the psychological world, we look down on repeat experiences. We think, you know, that initial novelty burst wears off and there's diminishing returns over time. You kind of view that idea skeptically. Why?
Well, that is one of the reasons I got interested in this topic. As a psychologist, if you look into the literature to find out, you know, how can I boost my happiness? How can I enjoy my time? Overwhelmingly, the advice you're going to get is seek out novelty, right? Variety is the spice of life. And I've struggled to bridge that, at, you know, academically looking into the literature with just noticing everyday behaviors. People often repeat things. They rewatch the same shows and movies, re-listen to the same songs. We hang art on the walls, the same art for years and years and years. And we don't always kind of get sick of those things. So that kind of launched my interest into studying this in the lab. And it turns out that many, many repeat experiences across different kinds of activities are indeed pretty enjoyable and much more enjoyable than we think when we're merely imagining them in our minds.
You had published some research on this about a year ago, so pre-COVID. Does it stand out to you as maybe even more important to examine these repeat experiences during this pandemic time?
It is a really important time for so many reasons. And I do think about, you know, if, again, that wisdom is seek out variety, seek out novelty, well, that's really hard for all of us these days to just go do something new. We can't do something new. We can't just leave our house and go to a new city or a new restaurant or whatever the case may be. So I do think about this research more in today's context, right? If the message of our findings, which does seem to be the message so far over the past year or so of research, well, is that repeat experiences do provide a lot of meaning and value and stimulation and enjoyment. I think it is important for people to know that when they're stuck inside with the same old things at their disposal, to fight their intuitions that there's nothing to do here, that they can't spend their time in a valuable way. You can spend your time in a valuable way by revisiting the things that you've already been to.
And Ed, I imagine people might have a gut reaction to whether they like new stuff or repeat experiences, and we could think about it, but how do you start to study it as a psychologist?
It's interesting. I mean, we start small and then kind of go bigger and broader. So starting small in the lab, we kind of bring people in back when there was an in-person lab before COVID shutdowns to experience some activity that we give them. We have them, you know, watch a film or play a video game or some type of exciting activity. And after they experience this thing once, then we ask them to report their imagination. So what's going to happen if you watch this again or play this again? Tell us what you're picturing, and they'll rate the experience, they'll rate their imagination. And then based on random assignment, we have some participants actually go through that experience again. So we have them in the lab rewatch that movie or replay that game, whatever the case may be. And then they rate the actual experience. So we can compare people's predicted enjoyment, predicted stimulation, to their actual reports of stimulation if they went through that experience themselves. And we see over and over and over again that people predict strong decline. So, hey, I enjoyed that movie the first time, but why do I have to sit around watching this movie again? I just saw it. But if you actually kind of force people to watch the same movie, they report a few interesting things. Number one, it's actually quite enjoyable, more enjoyable than they think. And number two, this is largely because we notice new things in the moment of repetition. So our imaginations are really bad at imagining the development of new information, right? When you're picturing what's it going to be like to rewatch the movie? Well, by definition, you play in your head the scenes that you can remember. And by definition, you can't bring to mind the scenes that you forget because you forgot them. So what happens when you actually sit down to watch the movie? Well, now all of those forgotten details are right in front of you. You're actually watching those things in real time. And because of that discovery process, we think that's a major reason why repetition proves to be more enjoyable than we think.
We've got a caller on this topic at 800-642-1234. Artemis is with us in Appleton. Artemis, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When I tuned in and heard you were talking about this, it reminded me of some previous research that I've read that supposedly people enjoy a movie or a book more if they know the ending ahead of time, which is kind of counterintuitive to what a lot of people think. And I just thought that sort of jived in with what you were discussing.
Artemis, thanks for that call. And I think, oh no, spoilers ruin things. And then I think, you know, people still watch Shakespeare, and we know Macbeth isn't going to say, you know what, let's not kill all these people, but they still enjoy it. So there's something there, isn't there, Ed?
Yeah, Artemis, I know exactly the research you're talking about. It's a great title of the paper. It's called Story Spoilers Don't Spoil Stories. And it's exactly in line with a lot of the work coming out of my lab. I mean, one reason why we think that is probably the case is because, all right, now you know the ending to the story, but now that gives you new information to play with at scene one, at scene two, at scene three. Right now you can track the moves. If you know the twist, it's kind of fun to see how it's being built towards that you didn't know beforehand. So again, it comes back to this discovery of new information, even if we know the ending to something.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about the benefits, the joys of repeating good experiences, going to the same place again, or reading the same book, watching the same movie, what have you. Ed O'Brien is with us, social psychologist at the University of Chicago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, in the olden days, a while back, I had this golden rule where I'd never watch movies more than once. I don't know why, because I could sit still and pretty much watch the whole movie. Now, I'm disabled, so I spent a lot of time sitting, you know, reading, watching TV. I did not have cable. I decided, well, I can afford it, so I recently got cable. And there's a channel on regular TV where they show old Westerns. Before cable, I would watch these. And, oh, I saw that one, but I would notice new things. The background, they filmed them in beautiful areas in the Southwest, and genuine antiques in the bar, and I'd notice this stuff, the background, and some of them were well-written. And then I got cable, and now I have choices like HBO, Showtime, and other choices. So when I see these movies on HBO, I'm kind of distracted. I get up, and I miss a part. I don't know how to hit pause. It doesn't work. But anyway, I'll watch that movie again and notice new things, and it just brings me a great deal of pleasure. Like I said, you know, with COVID, you can't get out, blah, blah, blah. So I'm adapting, you know, by golly, I spend a lot of time in front of the TV. I can afford cable. So that's one of the things I did for myself, and it's turning out really well. You know, I'm feeling pretty good as far as that goes. You know, I miss the grandchildren and all that, but that's about it. Okay?
Marcus, thank you so much. And that fits right in with what you're talking about, Eddie's layering up his enjoyment each time he watches that same movie.
Yeah, Mark is totally resonating with the research there. I mean, another interesting thing that Marcus brought up is, right, thinking about the overwhelming set of novel options, right? If you subscribe to Netflix or something like that, right, you can spend hours just flipping through, what am I going to watch tonight? And that's another kind of cost that economists and other types of researchers would want you to build into your decision, such that, you know, is it really worth your time to spend 2 hours trying to find something new rather than just immediately settling on an old favorite that you know you're going to enjoy, right? That ought to be incorporated in our decisions in a way that Marcus sounds like he's getting doing a really nice job there.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus. We got lots of callers here. We're talking about their repeat experiences. Terry is with us in Genoa. Terry, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Terry?
I'm really excited to hear this topic because I am a rereader, and my family and friends have always been astounded at how I can read the same book. I mean, not once, twice. I read the same books over and over every year. And for me, the same book, it's like sitting down with an old friend. It's like a favorite blanket and a cup of hot cocoa. It's like a favorite teddy bear. It's familiar. It's comforting, you know. Neil Gaiman's American Gods, I read that book at least once a year, every year.
Cool. Terry, thank you so much for sharing that. I was going to ask you to name some names, and you did. Yeah, my dad does that with The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings as well. And Ed, she said it was like curling up with an old friend with the characters in these books.
That's really, really well said. I mean, one thing that's coming out of our recent work, so this is some unpublished work, but we're following up on the original paper that was mentioned here. We find that meaning is an enormous driver of these kinds of decisions. So one thing that repeat experiences give us that a new and exciting option doesn't necessarily give us is this sense of personal meaning. It's kind of important to us in our identities, and we're kind of building into, you know, this is part of who I am, and we're signaling that to ourselves every time we go back to that old favorite. And again, that's a source of utility, that's a source of enjoyment that the new and exciting just simply can't offer us.
Terry, thanks so much. We're talking to Ed O'Brien, experimental social psychologist and associate professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. We're talking about his research on repeat experiences, doing good stuff again instead of seeking out novel stuff. And he says we enjoy it in general more than we think we're gonna. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has there been a time for you when you watched or visited or read something again and were surprised how much you got out of it? And has the pandemic felt like a series of repeat experiences? For better or worse, have you found ways to make those enjoyable? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Ed O'Brien, social psychologist at the University of Chicago, sharing his research about repeat experiences and why we enjoy them, the good ones anyway, more than we think we do in many cases. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Tim is with us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hello. Quite often on our long car rides down through Chicago, we will pop on a movie. I know that sounds crazy, but I'll hand my phone to somebody in the back seat, and I'll listen to a movie that I've watched 4, 5, 30 times in my life. And it's like I can see exactly what's happening on the screen, even though I can't see the phone at all.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you're not watching, Tim. But thank you so much for sharing that familiarity there, Ed. And he doesn't need to pay full attention to enjoy it, it sounds like.
Yeah, and that taps into kind of, I mentioned this earlier, we have kind of dual mechanisms of what explains why repeat experiences often are so enjoyable. One is this idea of discovery. So if we sit down to watch that movie again, we're noticing new things. But another one has to do with, again, the sense of meaning and identity. There's something powerful to the familiar, that just the mere fact that you can start to rehearse those lines and you don't even need to see the movie to understand what's going on. There's a sense of fluency there. There's a sense of familiarity there that psychologists have also cited as being a great source of pleasure for us. So I think that's going into Tim's comment for sure, this idea of the pleasures of familiarity.
Tim, thanks for the call. We heard from Val on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Val writes, I walk along my creek every day. Each day brings new delights and visuals, and the fresh air is awesome, too. But I like that idea. It is a repeat experience, but things change over time, and our perspective changes over time. In some ways, those repeat experiences are new experiences, aren't they, Ed?
It's kind of the old, you know, you cannot step into the same river twice kind of idea there, right? So even when, you know, you might be noticing new information in the movie, scenes you've forgotten, something like that, just the mere fact that you're perceiving it differently, you have a different interpretation now, maybe you're a little bit, you know, older and a different mindset or different circumstances, suddenly you're seeing that old favorite, the route that you take in a little different way, right? Every time we experience it is a little bit different on so many of those dimensions.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mike is with us in Eau Claire. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I really like the really dense books with a lot of characters where it's really tough to pick everything up on the first reading, so this is perfect. I was thinking of the book Suchery by Cormac McCarthy. I mean, I'm probably on, you know, I'll listen to that on audiobook, and I mean, it probably took me, you know, until the sixth listening at least.
Wow.
Until I finally figured out what the rag picker's first name was, and you know, same with I can't pronounce that, the Silmarillion by J.R. Tolkien.
Ooh, that's dense.
You know,
yeah,
so many names. That's a perfect book to just revisit, especially on audiobook.
Interesting, Mike. So that's another motivation there, Ed, to do repeat experiences, starting off with something dense and knowing you may not catch everything on the first 1 or 5 reads or listens.
Yeah, I love that comment from Mike because it's speaking to something I'm researching in the lab now, which is it's really hard for us to tell in advance what kinds of stimuli will be complex, like a giant Lord of the Rings novel. But you kind of know there's going to be a lot of information there. Versus what kinds of stimuli are more simple that are not worth your time to repeat. It's actually really hard for us to determine beforehand, right? If you try out a new Netflix show tonight and you thought it was fine, but it's not obvious that it's a Lord of the Rings type density, should you repeat it or not? And that's a challenging question that we're trying to figure out. The wisdom so far from our research is that at the very least, you should try to fight your intuition to immediately never go back to it, right? Our minds are built to tell us that we've seen all there is to see for all kinds of stimuli, even when they might be truly complex. So if you give something one more shot, Right? Maybe it proves to be simple and then you can cut ties, but we have to remember to give it one more shot before calling it quits.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Ed O'Brien from the University of Chicago, looking at his psychological research on repeat experiences, doing the same thing, reading a book, going to a place, what have you, and why it's more fun, more fulfilling than we might think. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Charlene is with us in Eau Claire County. Charlene, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Charlene?
Oh, I'm thrilled with this topic. In general, I don't like to watch movies again, but there are a few that would stand out, like Secretariat, or I go to books. And I think one of the things that draws me to John Sanford is his serializing of several characters and the ongoing characters that come back through each of the books. Lucas Davenport, and then the other one, the same with Clive Cussler when he does his serialization. So there's the familiarity there, but generally my husband and I got through the election and through the earlier part of the pandemic by rewatching West Wing and going all the way back and watching it sequentially, and that just gave us an enjoyable hour's escape on many days.
Charlene, thanks so much for sharing that with us. So in this case, with the pandemic in particular, Ed, that familiar TV show and going back and, I guess, watching the whole thing, which there's a lot of West Wing, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, thank you, Charlene. That's West Wing's a great example of something that, you know, as you go about your everyday life, you kind of just encoded it as, oh, yeah, I watched the West Wing back in the day, 10 years ago, whatever the case may be. I don't need to watch it again. And maybe something like the pandemic, now we're stuck inside much more than we were before, forces us to kind of think more deeply about what we thought we knew before. So again, West Wing, even though you've seen it, well, you've probably forgotten a whole lot. Or again, now you're in a different life stage and you can perceive it through a different lens if you watch it today than how you perceived it 10, 15 years ago. There's ample of those examples on Netflix and other outlets. Right? Fight the intuition. Oh yeah, been there, done that. Well, maybe if you give it another chance from today's light, it might be just as enjoyable as something new and exciting.
Interesting. Thanks for the call. Polly joins us now in Wauwatosa. Polly, hello.
Yes, I'm about to create a 3-day experience that I've never had before. And based on the pandemic and our family believes, you know, that we should keep each other safe and not get together. So while I was at the grocery store today, I decided, while I'm home alone, I'm 82 years old, I am going to have 3 Thanksgiving days in a row, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And I think that repeat will stick in my mind and my family's mind for a long time.
Polly, thank you for sharing that. I hope it is enjoyable, your 3 days of Thanksgiving. That sounds great. And that makes me think, Ed, you know, we do a similar Thanksgiving, a lot of the traditions, again and again, year after year. That might speak to the power of repeat experiences.
Yeah, you think rituals and other traditions that people have, right? Tapping into that psychology of meaning, I think that's probably a huge one in this example. Right? There's something extra special about, I like this idea of kind of Thanksgiving spread across 3 days. But if you did 3 different kinds of events in a row for 3 days, I think that would hit your memory in a different way. It would leave a different note as compared to doing, you know, you frame it as Thanksgiving 3 times in a row, right? That's going to leave a really powerful, personally meaningful memory that I agree will probably, you know, stick with you, become a tradition for years to come.
Happy Thanksgiving cubed to you, Polly. In our last few moments, Ed, is there something that you have found yourself going back to, maybe influenced in part by your research?
Interesting question. I mean, I do keep this research top of mind in my own everyday life. It's most salient to me when I catch myself looking for something new, because you realize, I mean, if you just do the calculus, how many hours you spend to try to find, you know, a new delivery place to get from or a new TV show to watch. And that's just a lot of investment for you. And I try to cut myself off, you know, maybe more so now than I did before I started this research, to realize, wait a second, if I have an old favorite that I already know I love and cherish, let's just jump right to that and start enjoying it rather than spending all night on a Google search.
Fantastic. Ed, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Ed O'Brien, an experimental social psychologist and associate professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He joined us for a look at his research that shows we often overlook repeat experiences that can actually be more enjoyable than trying something brand new. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, this is usually one of the biggest weeks for air travel in the U.S. An airline analyst tells us how much air travel is happening during the pandemic and how the industry is coping. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Think for a minute about Shakespeare plays as they might have been experienced during his lifetime. We know what they sounded like, more or less, because we have the scripts. We have a good idea what they looked like because we know about the theaters and costumes of the time. But did you ever wonder what a Shakespeare play at a live theater would have smelled like? Me neither. But now we can find out with a research project that's trying to recreate the smells of the 1500s in Europe. This news caught my eye after our great conversation about the science of smell just a week ago. As reported in The Guardian, a research project called Ode Europa is working to recreate the smellscape of 16th century Europe. They're researching documents from the time and info about trade and commerce to figure out what kind of smells people would encounter. And then they'll work on chemical recreations that museum exhibits could use to really bring us back to the distant past. The first thing that pops into my head is the limited sewage disposal systems of the time and less access to baths and showers. But the creators of the project say there's a lot more to the smell story. Incense used at churches, herbs carried to ward off disease, and of course, food. Plus a growing controversy at the time, the smell of tobacco, a new product in Europe at the time. And over the decades, it led to complaints about the overwhelming smell of tobacco at theaters. Research is ongoing. It's not quite ready yet. So to 16th century Europe, we can only say, smell you later. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.